Garbo listed every unit, genuine and invented, in the south of England, and calculated that the Allies must be left with some 50 divisions with which to attempt a second blow. He concluded with what sounded like an order. "I trust you will submit urgently all these reports and studies to our high command, since moments may be decisive in these times, and before taking a false step, through lack of knowledge of the necessary facts, they should have in their possession all the present information which I transmit with my opinion, which is based on the belief that the whole of the present attack is set as a trap for the enemy to make us move all our reserves in a hurried strategical disposition which we would later regret." If the receivers of this vast screed had paused to reflect, they might have registered how unlikely it was that a wireless would have been able to operate for more than 2 hours without detection. But they did not. Garbo's report, boiled down to readable form, hurtled up the chain of command, gaining traction as it went. From Madrid, it passed to Berlin, and then on to Berchtesgaden. There it was read by Friedrich Adolf Krumacher, the head of the High Command Intelligence Branch, who underlined the sentence describing the Normandy landing as diversionary, and passed it on to General Alfred Jodl, head of the OKW Operations Staff, who underlined South East and East England. Then it was handed to Hitler. The Führer's response may be deduced from the resulting intelligence assessment, which embraced Garbo's conclusions with the sort of blind enthusiasm ideologues usually display on being told what they already believe. "The report is credible. The reports received in the last week from the Arabelle undertaking have been confirmed almost without exception and are to be described as exceptionally valuable. The main line of investigation in future is to be the enemy group of forces in southeastern and eastern England." Elvira lent a hand with a letter in secret ink reporting, "Only part of Allied force in Normandy operation. Bulk remains here at present." The very artlessness and apparent naivete of her letters made them, in a different way, as powerful as Chernavsky's military reportage and Puyol's detailed analysis. 2 weeks after D-Day, she was still hinting at a looming second invasion, worrying about her overdraft, and wondering what to spread on her toast. "Lord Stanley of Alderney says bad weather hinders ships leaving south coast ports," she wrote. "Fruit spoiled by frosts, jam to be sent from America, still no money." As planned, as soon as Overlord was underway, Treasure, once the darling of the Double Cross team, was unceremoniously fired. Lily Sergeyev had taken extraordinary risks on behalf of British intelligence and played a crucial part, not just in the deception, but in winning Kleeman's trust, to the extent that her wireless traffic, relayed verbatim, had absolutely saved the bacon of GC and CS, the government code and cipher school at Bletchley, during June. But she had allowed her feelings to intrude into a business that had little time for such things. She had loved her dog too much, and in withholding information and seeking revenge for its death, she had broken the most fundamental rules of intelligence, and she was still refusing to reveal her control signal. 3 days after D-Day, Tarr came to the Hill Street flat to sack her in person, accompanied by Mary Shearer. He was wearing his Glengarry cap with tartan facing and the trousers of the Seaforth Highlanders. He sat in the armchair. Mary took up a position by the window. "I have some hard things to say. I'll come straight to the point."
"Go ahead," Lily said with mock insouciance.
Tarr did not easily rise to anger, but when he did, he flushed crimson. Gripping the arms of the chair, Robertson leaned forward. "Mary has told me that when you were in Lisbon, you arranged a security check. We have accordingly decided that you are no longer trustworthy. It is quite impossible for me to place any confidence in someone who behaves in this manner. You will not transmit any more. We'll do that ourselves. We have already started to work without you." Lily smiled. Tarr turned a deeper shade of red. "The situation is as follows. You ceased to work for us. We shall continue to pay you £5 a week for your maintenance. As soon as possible, I shall organize your return to Paris. You must leave this flat.
You have a fortnight to clear out. Lily said nothing. Tar was beginning to boil. If I have any cause to think that you are in any way acting contrary to the interests of the Allied cause, I will at once take severe action and either put you in prison or hand you over to the French authorities, who would no doubt deal with you pretty severely. Lily noticed a darning hole in the left knee of his tartan trousers. Tar was unshaven and looked tired and a little shabby, she thought. Tar waited for a response. What do you have to say?
Your first allegation is correct, said Lily, and you can keep your money.
You will take the money whether you like it or not. You can do what you like with it after that. I suppose that you don't want to give us the security check? Lily shrugged.
You said a while ago I couldn't be trusted, she muttered. If I gave you the sign, how would you know it is not exactly the opposite of what you wanted?
Tara had had enough of the game. I didn't say we would believe you. Without another word, he left, followed by Mary Shearer. As soon as she heard the front door close, Lily burst into tears, of self-pity, perhaps, but also of regret. This had been, as she later put it, the big scene from Act Three. She had planned to end the drama in her own way, either as a heroine for the Allies, or by blowing the whole operation in retaliation for the death of Babs. Instead, she was being sent away with a meager payoff and a dressing down from a man with a red face and a hole in his trousers. In a last attempt to get Lily to divulge the control signal, Tar sent Gisella Ashley to see her. They had always gotten on well, and Gisella was handy at extracting information.
Why did you do it? She asked.
I refused to be beaten by them, by your damned intelligence service.
Gisella Ashley put her arm around Lily.
Ducky, that's just pride.
In a rare moment of self-knowledge, Lily wrote in her diary,
I have destroyed my own work, or at any rate, rendered it useless.
Double Cross was built on sideways thinking, but as Operation Fortitude stretched beyond D-Day, the thinking went from lateral to outlandish. Intoxicated by their success, Hugh Astor and Roman Chernovsky came up with an idea that was ingenious, daring, and quite mad. What if they could entice the Germans into sending an assassination squad to kill General Eisenhower and his senior officers at the fake headquarters of the fake army? The plan was simple. Brutus would send an urgent radio message to Reiler, inviting the Germans to make an airborne raid on the notional FUSAG headquarters at Wentworth. The message would read, General Eisenhower and a few other eminent persons are holding a conference, at the end of which Eisenhower is to address all officers. This represents an ideal and unprecedented opportunity for capturing or destroying some of the most eminent personages on which the success of the invasion depends. Wentworth, Brutus would point out, is surrounded by golf courses suitable for airborne landings. Chernovsky himself would flash a torch to indicate the exact landing point and direct the raiders to the mess where the exalted persons will be holding their post-prandial celebrations. Immediately on landing, the German paratroopers would be ambushed and taken prisoner. Arrangements will have to be made to give the raiders a suitable reception and to ensure none of them escape. Chernovsky would need an excuse for why the assassination plot had failed. On the following day, Brutus will himself transmit a furious message, explaining that although he was vigorously flashing his lantern, the airborne troops landed several fields away, where they were naturally rounded up by the Home Guard. The plot, Astor argued, would reinforce German belief in the invented army in the southeast. If the Germans refuse to play, no harm will have been done, as the threat to the Pas-de-Calais will have been continued, and Brutus will again have shown himself to be a man of courage and resource. The Germans surely could not resist this appetizing dish. Tar Robertson rejected the idea out of hand, pointing out that there were easier ways to catch German attention than inciting heavily armed Nazi assassins to run around the golf courses of the home counties in the middle of the night, looking for American generals to kill. Some elements of the grand deception were more effective than others. Flight Lieutenant Richard Walker had spent months preparing his pigeon double-cross scheme. He recruited hundreds of second-rate homing pigeons, equipped them with faked German leg rings, and dropped them over occupied Europe in the expectation that they would destroy the German pigeon service from within. Walker's grand deception was a damp squab. There is no evidence that it had any effect whatsoever. The Germans never detected the double agent pigeons in their midst. Indeed, when the Wehrmacht officer in command of the pigeon service was interrogated after the war and asked whether his lofts might have been infiltrated by Allied pigeons, he responded that such a thing was impossible, since the impostors would have been spotted immediately. No one, he said, could attach a fake leg ring to a pigeon without soldering it. This, of course, was precisely what Walker had managed to do. The plot failed because of its excessive ingenuity. The double agent pigeons, too feeble to fly home, simply blended in with the local pigeon populations and, like so many ex-combatants, made new lives for themselves, their wartime heroics unsuspected and, until now, unsung. The charade of Monty's double may also have had only a limited effect on German thinking. The mise-en-scène in Gibraltar was certainly reported back to Berlin, but as MI5 candidly admitted, what they deduced from it, and how far it had any effect upon their plans, unfortunately we have never been able to find out. The ruse may have concentrated German attention on a possible landing in the south of France, but the meeting between the fake General Montgomery and the real General Wilson at Algiers does not appear to have been reported to von Rundstedt, or to have affected German defense of the Channel. The most that can be said of Operation Copperhead is that it compounded German confusion and provided considerable entertainment for its organizers. It also put paid to Molina Perez, whose career as a Nazi spy came to an abrupt end. Armed with hard evidence of his espionage activities, the British declared the Spanish officer persona non grata and permanently excluded him from Gibraltar, much to his baffled annoyance. Elbera's telegram warning of the imminent attack on the Bay of Biscay undoubtedly reached German intelligence, although the invasion was graded at most a small-caliber operation. Even so, it was considered real enough that when German reconnaissance spotted Allied convoys near Brest, it was assumed these must be heading for the Biscay area for a diversionary attack. Allied military planners had anticipated that within a week of D-Day, two panzer divisions would be sent from southwestern France to Normandy. In fact, only one, the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, headed north to join the counterattack, and even that did not move immediately. It finally reached Normandy and engaged in combat on June 11th. The 11th Panzer Division remained in position, defending southwestern France from an attack that never came. John Masterman was sure that this was attributable to Elbera. When the invasion took place, the Panzer Division was kept in the Bordeaux area and not pushed north at once towards Cherbourg. Astor agreed. Their movement of a Panzer Division to the Bordeaux area may to some extent be attributed to Bronx's telegram, ensuring that those troops remained impotent near Bordeaux while the battle raged in Normandy. Elbera's follow-up letter, suggesting that the Biscay invasion might yet happen, further muddied the waters. As late as July, General Jodl told Admiral Abe, the Japanese naval attaché in Berlin, that a second series of invasions was expected. We are prepared for landings in the vicinity of Bordeaux. Agent Bronx and Operation Ironside may not have fully convinced the Germans that an attack on southwestern France was imminent or even likely, but they undoubtedly added to German confusion. And the credit for that uncertainty goes, in large part, to a frivolous party girl who lied about meeting a drunken officer in a club and told her spymasters of a conversation that never took place. The stated limited aim of Fortitude North had been to contain some first-quality divisions in Scandinavia by a threatened assault on Norway. In this, it succeeded, though perhaps less dramatically than hoped. The Germans certainly believed in the fictional Fourth Army under General Thorn, but they seemed to have assumed that it was not big enough, or sufficiently backed by air cover, to do more than mount a diversionary attack. In early May, the Germans had described an attack on Norway as a strong possibility, and action against Denmark as a certainty. The 17 German divisions across Scandinavia were put on full alert. The Germans certainly feared an attack, albeit not on a large scale. The deception may not have persuaded Hitler to do anything he was not already disposed to do, but it undoubtedly encouraged him to continue doing something he was already doing, and the Allies needed him to continue doing. At no point did Hitler redeploy the 250,000 troops in Norway to the real zone of destiny in northern France. If some subsidiary elements of Operation Fortitude were of debatable effectiveness, the main thrust of the deception was an undisputed, unalloyed, world-changing triumph. As the Battle of Normandy raged, the Germans held fast to the illusion, so carefully planted and now so meticulously sustained, that a great American army under Patton was preparing to pounce, and the German forces in the Pas-de-Calais must remain in place to repel it. On D-Day itself, von Rohner insisted that another landing would come in the 15th Army area, and no troops would be withdrawn from there. Rommel agreed, arguing that the forces in the north should not be weakened. Nonetheless, the 15th Army reserves were mobilized, and on June 9th, the mighty 1st Panzer Division, 25,000 strong, was ordered to head south from the Pas-de-Calais to join the counterattack against the Allied bridgehead. But then came Garbo's explicit warning that the Normandy invasion was a ruse, specifically designed to draw off troops from Calais before the main assault. The order to the 1st Panzers was countermanded. The division would remain in place for another crucial week. Several factors were at work in that decision, but Field Marshal Keitel later stated he was 99% certain that the warning from Garbo provided the reason for the change of plan. A week after D-Day, only one German division had moved from the Pas-de-Calais to Normandy. German belief in the Phantom Army was unshakable. On June 23rd, Oshima reported to Tokyo that 23 divisions commanded by General Patton are being held in readiness to make new landings. This is one reason why Germany has avoided pouring a great number of men into the Normandy area. Physical proof of success came when the British forces in Italy captured a map drawn up by German intelligence on June 15th that showed exactly where the enemy believed the 2nd Allied Army was waiting in southeastern England to cross the Channel. "It was almost identical with Plan Fortitude," wrote Liddell. A month after D-Day, no fewer than 22 German divisions were still held back in the 15th Army sector. "Patton's Army Group," Jodl reported, "is being made ready in London and in southern England for the next landing." The ever-helpful Oshima confirmed that the Germans still expected that Patton's forces will land in the neighborhood of Dieppe. Hitler had reposed an almost mystic confidence in Garbo, MI5 later concluded, and even in late July, he still could not rid his mind of the belief that a second landing was intended. But von Rohner was now starting to have doubts, or pretending to. After warning for weeks that another, even larger attack was coming, he began to hedge his bets, suggesting that Fussag has not been given the decisive role after all. Perhaps, like all experts, he was just adopting new certainties as events unfolded. But perhaps von Rohner had never been fooled by the chimera of Patton's army, which he had done so much to reinforce. By July 27th, he was singing a new tune. "A second major landing on the Channel coast no longer seems to be so probable in view of the situation in Normandy." 7 weeks after the first landings, four divisions were finally released from the 15th Army to head south, far too late. As Eisenhower put it, "Every additional soldier who then came into the Normandy area was then caught up in the catastrophe of defeat." The bridgehead, so vulnerable in the first days and weeks, was firmly established. The war was not won, but the end was in sight. Looking back, the most clear-sighted German officer knew that the failure to counterattack in Normandy had cost Germany the battle, and perhaps the war. Shortly before he was forced to kill himself, Rommel conceded that it had been a decisive mistake to leave the German troops in the Pas-de-Calais. But far from realizing they had been fooled, the Germans assumed that Allied plans had changed. On August 30th, Garbo reported that the planned attack on the Pas-de-Calais had been cancelled, and the Germans believed him, as they had believed him from the start. Only later did the truth dawn. All this pattern business wasn't a trick, was it? Professor Percy Schramm, the keeper of the OKW war diary, asked his interrogators. Were all those divisions sent to southeast England simply to hold our forces in the Pas-de-Calais? But others clung to the deception long after the war was over. Jodl was interrogated in 1946, still congratulating himself on being fooled. We knew that you had one army group in the south of England and one in the southeast. We know now that the southeastern army group was not in fact launched against the Channel coast, but its continued presence in the southeast of England constituted a threat which it was not possible for us to ignore. We therefore did not feel justified in authorizing any large-scale release of 15th Army formations for use in Normandy until a considerable time after the invasion had started. Had our picture of your dispositions in the UK been less complete, and had we not been aware of the presence of the 1st US Army Group in the southeast of England, we might have dispatched more of the 15th Army to Normandy earlier, which might have had very serious results for yourselves. On the Allied side, there was no doubt that the Germans had been induced to make what Major General Kenneth Strong, Eisenhower's intelligence chief, called an unparalleled blunder. If the huge German army in the north had been deployed to Normandy at once, instead of waiting for a second invasion, then the Allies would have faced an even bloodier fight, with every possibility of defeat. Those additional forces might well have tipped the scales against us, wrote Eisenhower. I cannot overemphasize the importance of maintaining as long as humanly possible the Allied threat to the Pas-de-Calais area, which has already paid enormous dividends and, with care, will continue to do so. Montgomery concurred. The deception measures, he wrote, played a vital part in our successes in Normandy. The Double Cross report for Churchill was a fully justified hymn of self-congratulation. It seems from all indications that the Germans have accepted the stories which we have told them about an impending attack on the Pas-de-Calais. It seems pretty clear that the congratulatory messages, especially to Garbo, to some extent reflect the general military appreciation of the German high command. It is known for a fact that the Germans intended at one time to move certain divisions from the Pas-de-Calais area to Normandy. But, in view of the possibility of a threat to the Pas-de-Calais area, these troops were either stopped on their way to Normandy and recalled, or it was decided that they should not be moved at all. John Masterman knew, as Churchill did not, just how close the deception had come to disaster. We were not very far from failure, just before the period of our greatest success, he later wrote. But the team had put on a superb all-around performance in what his colleague in American intelligence, Norman Holmes Pearson, called the greatest test match of the century. After the war, British intelligence combed through captured records and established exactly which elements in German military thinking could be traced directly to agents' reports. Only 11 of Tate's messages registered with the German analysts. Garbo's network clocked an impressive 86, but it was Brutus who made the highest score, with no fewer than 91 messages reflected in the German intelligence summaries, just 9 short of his century. The post-match analysis was, and remains, universally admiring. Thaddeus Holt, author of the most comprehensive account of wartime deception, has called Operation Fortitude the most successful strategic deception of all time. Even Kim Philby, that master of deceit, called it one of the most creative intelligence operations of all time. But the most important tribute to the deception's success came from the Germans themselves. On July 29th, nearly 2 months after D-Day, Kulenthal sent a wireless message to Garbo. With great happiness and satisfaction, I am able to advise you today that the Führer has awarded the Iron Cross to you for your extraordinary merits, a decoration which, without exception, is granted only to frontline combatants. For that reason, we all send you our most sincere and cordial congratulations. In reply, Garbo professed to be so overcome with pride and emotion that he was lost for words. Then the words came tumbling out in a great, frothing torrent.
I cannot at this moment, when emotion overcomes me, express in words my gratitude for the decoration conceded by our Führer, to whom humbly and with every respect I express my gratitude for the high distinction which he has bestowed on me, for which I feel myself unworthy, as I have never done more than what I have considered to be the fulfillment of my duty. Furthermore, I must state that this prize has been won not only by me, but also by the other comrades, who, through their advice and directives, have made possible my work here. And so the congratulations are mutual. My desire is to fight with great ardor to be worthy of this medal, which has only been conceded to those heroes, my companions in honor, who fight on the battlefront. You can almost hear Puyol and Harris sniggering with glee in the background, but Garbo was right to see the award as a collective honor. He had not mounted the deception alone. His comrades included the agents he had invented, the other real agents and their own inventions, and behind them the men and women who built the system, the case officers, spymasters, and inspired dissemblers who imagined the double-cross project, and the far-sighted planners who, amazingly, let them get on with it. Those who fought on the battlefront of D-Day never knew that a Polish patriot, a Peruvian gambling girl, a French dog lover, a Serbian playboy, and a Spanish chicken farmer, together and in deepest secrecy, had lied them to victory. Agent Garbo accepted the Iron Cross on behalf of them all. Aftermath. In German eyes, Agent Brutus had proved himself the noblest Roman. In the wake of D-Day, having failed to predict the real invasion and pumped his handlers full of lies about the false one, he could do no wrong. Most secret sources showed that his reports were being studied not only by the operational sections, but by the most prominent persons in Berlin, including Hitler and Goering. German intelligence regarded him as an oracle, a sage. We shall presently reach a stage where high-level questions on military matters are addressed personally to Brutus, Astor crowed. In July 1944, a flying bomb landed in Barnes in southwest London, blowing out the windows of 61 Richmond Park Road and leaving Monique Czernowski with serious facial injuries. MI5's bean counters agreed to pay the £50 needed for plastic surgery, noting that Czernowski had worked valiantly for us over a long period of time without receiving any remuneration. In his assumed role as a secret international statesman, Czernowski bombarded the Germans with unsolicited and unhelpful advice. "Nobody here believes any more in a German victory," he told them. "As a Pole, can I suggest that neither is it in our interest nor in yours that the Russians be allowed to occupy Central Europe? I believe this is a good psychological moment for attempting to reach an agreement with the Anglo-Saxons, and I am inclined to think they may accept your military propositions." The reply came back from Reiler, "Once again, I thank you with all my heart for your excellent work. I have passed on all your political propositions, especially concerning your country, recommending them to accept them." Still hungry for an Iron Cross, Astor longed to deploy Czernowski in one final deception and suggested parachuting him into France ahead of the retreating German forces. Once there, he would contact German intelligence and explain that he had been sent by the British to recruit and organize an intelligence service behind the lines, and offer to work for Germany again. He would then be in a position to receive the Germans' deception plans, which might reveal their real intentions. No other spy had made so many journeys back and forth between loyalty and betrayal. First an agent in occupied Paris, then a double agent for the Germans, then a triple agent, working for the Allies once more. He now offered to go back to France as a quadruple agent, while in reality a quintuple agent, still working for Britain. By the terms of the deal with the Germans,
Chernovsky's family and former colleagues in the Inter Alia network would not be harmed if he played his part. When Paris was liberated, so were the hostages. Before leaving, the Germans left a final token of their faith. Beside the road out of Paris, Weiler dug a hole, in which he buried a new radio transmitter and 50,000 French francs, in the expectation that if the indefatigable agent Hubert arrived with the advancing Allied troops, he would wish to keep in touch, an act that hardly squares with Weiler's later claim that he knew Chernovsky was a double agent. On National 3, between Paris and Meaux, there is a milestone which, according to the inscription upon it, is 2.3 kilometers from Clay and 12.4 kilometers from Meaux. The equipment is concealed 5 meters from this stone in a ditch under a mark on the grass, buried 10 centimeters deep. The German retreat was too swift to put the quintuple cross plan into operation, and Chernovsky's parting gift from his German spymaster was forgotten. In the 1960s, Route Nationale 3 was widened, covering over the hiding place. Every day, thousands of motorists on the road from Paris to the German border pass over this buried memento to Agent Brutus. After the war, Roman Chernovsky settled in Britain. Though he thought a Polish government set up by Moscow is a degree better than having no Polish government at all, he could never return to his homeland with the communist regime in power. He was secretly appointed an officer of the most excellent order of the British Empire for his wartime role. He became a printer, settled in West London, amicably divorced Monique, remarried, divorced, married again. He adored cats, and in old age he liked to sit in his front room watching James Bond films with his cats. The cat population in the Chernovsky household eventually reached 32. He never lost his heavy Polish accent or his whole-souled Polish patriotism, and he intrigued to the end, spending his final years secretly working for the Solidarity movement. He died in 1985, aged 75. Mathilde Carré, once Chernovsky's partner in the Inter Alia network, was extradited to France in January 1949 after 6 years in British prisons and charged with treason. The trial of the cat was a sensation. She sat wordless throughout, with a withdrawn air of detachment, as 33 witnesses came forward to denounce her for sleeping with the enemy. The prosecution summed up with an entry from her own diary, from the night she first made love to Hugo Bleicher. "What I wanted most was a good meal, a man, and, once more, Mozart's Requiem." Mathilde was sentenced to death, later commuted to hard labor for life. In Rennes prison, she suffered cat-filled nightmares. She was finally released in 1954. A few months later, she was approached by Bleicher, who had served time in prison and was now running a tobacconist in Württemberg. He asked her to write a book with him, a harmless literary collaboration, he called it. She had done enough collaborating with Bleicher and wrote her own book, I Was the Cat, insisting that her crimes had been committed to achieve a noble, patriotic ideal. Few believed her. She died in 1970, a recluse. Mathilde Carré was either treacherous or just desperately unlucky. Like Chernovsky, she claimed she had only worked for the Germans in order to betray them. As her lawyer argued, at certain moments in the life of a spy, the double cross is all part of the game. Chernovsky felt a residual sympathy for his fellow spy, forced by war to make impossible choices in circumstances not of her own making. Years later, he was still troubled by her fate. "I don't know how I would have behaved," he wrote. "Do you?" A month after D-Day, Lily Sergeyev divulged her last secret. Mary Shearer had turned up with a cake and invited Lily to come for a walk. She was still fishing for the control sign, and as they walked down Piccadilly, she asked Lily, for the last time, to reveal the arrangement she had made with Kliman. She asked her not as an MI5 case officer, but as a friend. It was the nearest these two diametrically different women, one melodramatically French and the other so stolidly English, had come to intimacy. Lily suddenly turned to her former case officer.
Okay, you win.
On a piece of paper she sketched out, the system of dashes agreed with Kleeman to indicate when she was operating her wireless under British control. Is that all? Lily nodded. Mary raced back to the office, pulled out the file for Agent Treasure, and extracted the wireless traffic, every message sent by Lily since her return from Lisbon. Sometimes Lily had put a dash in the original, sometimes in the repeated message, and sometimes in neither, but never in both. There was no double dash. Lily had never gone through with her threat. MI5 had been sent into a completely needless tailspin by the fear that their D-Day plan had been fatally undermined by a hysterical woman in mourning for her dog. But by putting her British handlers through the mill and keeping her secret until revealing it made no difference, Lily felt she had evened up the score. "I will be able to close my notebooks and forget," she wrote in her diary. "One forgets quickly. Maybe it's for the best." Babs was avenged. When peace came, Lily was soon reunited with her parents in Paris. "My joy has no end," she wrote. Lily then took a job with the US occupation forces in Germany, helping to administer vaccinations under the command of Major Bart Collings, a bluff former parachutist from the Midwest, who was most attentive to her. "I've lost my solitary state," she wrote. "I'm no longer alone." Her health improved, and for the first time in her life, she was completely happy. But Lily had not quite finished tormenting MI5. In March 1946, Billy Luke warned Tara Robertson that Lily was planning to write a book about her wartime experiences. "You may find your name appearing in a first-class spy thriller." Tara was aghast. "I don't honestly think there is anything we can do with this wretched woman," he told Gisella Ashley. "She will always be a source of trouble to us, no matter what restrictions we put on her, short of imprisonment for life. I don't know if there is anything you can say which might appeal to her better nature, if she has one." He need not have worried. The book would not appear for another 20 years. Lily was simply doing what she had done before, driving the straight-laced British into a lather with a threat she would not carry out. In 1947, Bart Collings and Lily Sergeyev married and moved to Michigan. Theirs was a happy marriage, though childless and tragically brief. Lily's illness returned, this time with a vengeance. She died of kidney failure in 1950. Difficult, petulant, and spirited, she had played a double-edged role in the Double Cross story, a mainstay of the deception who had planned to destroy it. The good folk of St. Mary's Avenue, Detroit, had no inkling that Mrs. Collings, the excitable French woman with many dogs who lived at number 17542, was really Agent Treasure, a spy of the highest value, whose life, in her own words, had been one of unbelievable reality. Juan Puyol maintained the facade, and the Germans loved him to the end. "We have in your personality, your character, your valor, all those virtues that become a gentleman." As the Third Reich disintegrated in a welter of blood and fury, Garbo exhorted his handlers to keep the Nazi faith. "The noble struggle will be revived," he told Kuhlenthal. "I only regret not being at your side." The last act of the drama was the dismantling of a network that had never existed. Even the Welsh fascists were becoming disillusioned, Puyol reported. "They cannot hope for anything from us." Garbo's final wireless message was a wordy eulogy to the martyred Hitler. His deeds and the story of his sacrifice to save the world from the danger of anarchy which threatens us will last forever in the hearts of all men of goodwill, he waffled. "I am certain that the day will arrive in the not-too-distant future when the noble struggle will be revived." On May 8, 1945, the Catalan watched the crowd celebrating in central London and allowed himself a flush of private pride. After the war, MI5 wondered whether to continue his espionage career by selling him to the Soviets. If recruited by Moscow, he might be able to deceive the KGB as he had once foxed the Abwehr. But Garbo knew when to leave the stage. he had extracted an estimated $350,000 from the Germans and an Iron Cross. The British gave him £15,000 and appointed him a member of the most excellent order of the British Empire. He divorced Araceli and settled in Venezuela. A lifelong lover of language and literature, he became a Spanish teacher for Shell Oil and opened a bookshop. At his urging, Tommy Harris spread a rumor that Puyol had died of malaria in Angola. Garbo slipped quietly and completely out of the limelight, settling in Zulia on the shores of Lake Maracaibo. No one knew about my past. Nobody knew what I had done. In 1984, he briefly emerged from the shadows when the writer, Nigel West, found him and persuaded him to return to London for a formal recognition of his wartime achievements at Buckingham Palace. He then disappeared back to Venezuela. He died in 1988 and is buried in Curaçao by the sea. My main pride and satisfaction, he wrote, has been the knowledge that I contributed to the reduction of casualties among the tens of thousands of servicemen fighting to hold the Normandy beachheads. Many, many more would have perished had our plan failed. Puyol was a warrior who fought to save lives, not to take them, using words as his only weapons. Elvira de la Fuente Chaudois, the sexually venturesome, boredom-prone gambler with the elegant fingernails, had proved her worth. As the Third Reich collapsed, she was deployed to find out which elements in the German hierarchy might sue for peace. Bronx is the most suitable of all B-1A cases for a political role, wrote Astor. They will take the initiative in putting out definite peace feelers through Bronx. Elvira wrote a letter on August 15, 1944, offering her continued services to Germany, at a price. It is quite evident that you have lost the war, and I am extremely worried that the advancing Allied armies may come into possession of my dossier, which would provide evidence of my espionage activities. Will you please give me an assurance that all incriminating evidence will be destroyed? I am prepared to go on working, even after the war if you wish, provided that you continue to pay me. The response was as keen as ever. Good work. Write quickly and often. Elvira was instructed to go to Madrid, make contact with German intelligence, and learn as much as possible about German ideas on peace terms, but not in any way attempt to act as intermediary between the two powers. The idea that Elvira could conceivably have acted as an international go-between would once have been regarded as ludicrous. The good-time girl had come a long way. Elvira flew to Madrid on December 19, 1944. I believe that she will make a good job of it, Astor wrote. She is likely to be closely questioned about her telegram threatening Bordeaux. Bronx has never met Ormes Bigon, but I have attempted to give her a description of him and believe that she is now able to give a colourful account of the incident. Before leaving, she told Astor that if any mishap should befall her, I should notify her friend Miss Monica Sherif. With that, she set off in cheerful heart. But by now the German intelligence organization in Madrid, once a byword for ruthless efficiency, had all but disintegrated. Elvira could find not a single German spy. Back in London, she dispatched a furious letter of complaint to the Germans. Absolutely livid about the uselessness of the journey, which was expensive and disagreeable. You let me down. I only made the journey because I was expecting a handsome bonus. She received an abject apology and a request to send word if she learned of another Allied invasion in Scandinavia or northern Germany. The suggested code was almost identical to the one she had used before D-Day. This time, the demand for £50 for her dentist would indicate Denmark, whereas a request for £100 would mean parachuting to the west of Berlin and landing in the German bay. Here was fresh evidence that the earlier ruse had worked. It is difficult to believe that the Germans would have used this same code again, Masterman observed, if they had been dissatisfied with its use by Bronx in May 1944. The Germans eagerly await her news and will probably believe any information she puts over, said Astor, and as the end drew near, she passed on news intended to lower the German will to resist and encourage capitulation.
Guerrillas will be treated without mercy, she reported, citing her friends in the government. Agent Bronx was helping to shape post-war Germany. The debt-driven spy recruited as a gamble and picked up in a French casino had paid huge dividends. MI5 was delighted. Her long-term possibilities should not be overlooked. There would be no long-term career. The declaration of peace brought a simultaneous declaration from Elvira that she was retiring from espionage. She received a parting gift of £197. Words of gratitude and appreciation were freely expressed on both sides. She moved to a small village in the south of France, having inherited the remains of her father's guano fortune. For the next half a century, she ran a gift shop called L'Heure Bleue in Beaulieu-sur-Mer on the Côte d'Azur. She avoided casinos, but ran short of money nonetheless. In 1995, Hugh Astor informed Stella Rimington, then Director General of MI5, that the former Agent Bronx was broke. In December 1995, Elvira received a check for £5,000 as a way of making the point that her wartime service is still remembered and appreciated. Elvira died a month later at the age of 85. To some, her later life may have seemed dull, but Elvira was never bored again. Of her role in the war, she remarked, I recall the adventure as the most wonderful and intense period of my life. With the coming of peace, Dushko Popov, the playboy spy, got married, became British, and was awarded a medal, marks of respectability that did nothing whatsoever to change his habits. I am getting fed up with my married friends criticizing my immoral life, he told Billy Luke, his first case officer, adding that his fiancée was a young and pretty French girl, just your type. He married Janine on March 6, 1946, in Megève, France. Popov's bride was just 18, but apparently entering into this matrimonial adventure with her eyes open, MI5 noted sardonically. His application for citizenship was swiftly approved. I will try to do my best to be worthy of my new country, he told Tar Robertson. I am still at your disposal whenever you think I might be useful. A year later, they met at the bar of the Ritz, where Tar handed Popov a leather box containing an OBE in recognition of his role in deceiving the enemy prior to the Normandy invasion. Tar apologized for the unorthodox presentation ceremony, but the setting could hardly have been more appropriate. An espionage relationship that had started at the Savoy was brought to a close at the Ritz. The British Secret Services were still trying to disentangle Popov's finances long after the war ended. We are making arrangements as regards the receipts for his furniture, wrote Kim Philby in 1948 with infinite weariness. Popov's businesses prospered, though never conventionally. One week, Tal Air Limited was trading cholera serum to the Egyptian government. The next, Popov was importing Peugeot cars, selling rubber hose to the French, and setting up a German textile industry. His activities have freewheeled far outside any MI5 commitment, observed Ian Wilson, who started acting as Popov's solicitor as soon as he ceased to be his case officer. Popov purchased a castle overlooking Nice. His marriage did not last. He met a blonde 18-year-old Swedish student named Jill Jonsson in 1961 and married her the following year. They moved into the former summer palace of the Bishop of Grasse. His finances remained opaque, his tastes extravagant, and his mysterious glamour undimmed. Only in 1974, when the truth about Britain's wartime deceptions began to emerge, did Popov reveal that he had been Agent Tricycle. His book, Spy Counterspy, was vigorously written, entertaining, and partly invented. James Bond was all the rage, and the book contained scenes straight from the 007 playbook. Gorgeous women appearing naked in his hotel bedroom, punch-ups with evil Nazis, the staking of thousands of dollars on the turn of a card. Popov was a conscientious spy who told his British case officers everything. None of these episodes appears in the MI5 files. Popov's true story reads like fiction, but like most spies, he could not resist making it up. In the 1970s,
Popoff and his brother Ivo, the former Agent Dreadnought, opened a rejuvenation clinic in the Bahamas, an appropriate last venture for a man who continued to live life like a 25-year-old. He died in 1981 at the age of 69. Most of the B-1A team drifted back into civilian life. In 1948, Tar Robertson retired to Worcestershire to look after sheep, farming his flock as gently and cleverly as he had tended the Double Cross agents. John Masterman, soon Sir John, OBE, became Provost of Worcester College, Oxford, then Vice Chancellor of that university. He played cricket, wrote detective novels, sat on various worthy boards, and scandalized some of his former colleagues in 1971 by publishing his account of the Double Cross system in defiance of the Official Secrets Act. Hugh Astor became Middle East correspondent of the Times and covered the birth of an independent Israel before joining the newspaper's board in 1956. Billy Luke resumed his business career and in 1958 became Master of the Worshipful Company of Makers of Playing Cards of the City of London. Christopher Harmer returned to practicing the law. In memory of his favorite double agent, the Harmers would occasionally go to the Hyde Park Hotel Bar and drink a cocktail made from rum, orange juice, and vermouth, called the Bronx. Mary Shearer met Phyllis McKenzie, who had worked for British intelligence in New York during the war, and the two women became inseparable. They lived together for the rest of their lives, perfect foils for each other. Within MI5, they were assumed to be lesbians, or rather, lesbians. Together they moved to Rome and opened the Lion Bookshop on Via del Babuino, near the Spanish Steps. Mary was a very fast runner, and would think nothing of pursuing the rather numerous petty thieves that abounded in Rome during and after the war. She loved a challenge. This formidable pair of English ladies, known as the Lionesses, spent their days surrounded by books and a large posse of dogs, Pekingese, French bulldogs, and pugs, all of which Mary doted on. Flight Lieutenant Walker spent the rest of his days happily breeding pigeons. Gustav, the pigeon who brought back the first news of D-Day, was awarded the Dickin Medal, the animal equivalent of the Victoria Cross, to signalize its performance on D-Day. Gustav died soon after the war when his breeder trod on him while mucking out his loft. Tommy Harris settled in Spain after the war, where he painted and gave memorable parties, at which he told outrageous spy stories that few believed. He was killed in 1964 at the age of 54, after his car spun off a road in Mallorca and crashed into a tree. Some saw the accident as sinister. Guy Liddell remained in MI5, a continued fount of good humor and good sense. There is no doubt that the Russians are far better in the matter of espionage than any other country in the world, he wrote prophetically in 1945. They will be a great source of trouble to us when the war is over. When the Cambridge spies were finally exposed, Liddell would be caught up in the scandal and, even unfairly, suspected of being a double agent himself. Anthony Blunt left MI5 as soon as the war ended and resumed his career as an academic. He was knighted, courted, and feted, and went on to become Professor of the History of Art at the University of London, Director of the Courtauld Institute of Art, and Surveyor of the Queen's Pictures. When he was finally outed as a spy in 1979 and publicly disgraced, he became a semi-recluse, taking refuge in whiskey and concentrated work. In a posthumously published memoir, Blunt wrote that spying for the Soviets had been the biggest mistake of my life. Yet, soon after his exposure as a double agent, he bumped into Tar Robertson and told the former boss of B1A, "It has given me great pleasure to have been able to pass the names of every MI5 officer to the Russians." Other players in the Double Cross team faded into obscurity. Wolf Schmidt, Agent Tate, became Harry Williamson, a British citizen, a photographer on the Watford Observer, a breeder of tropical fish, and a respected judge at cage bird exhibitions around the country. Paul Fidromuch, Agent Ostro, invented spy reports for the Germans until the end of the war, and then vanished. He achieved immortality 11 years later, when Graham Greene, who had seen reports on both Garbo and Ostro as a young MI6 officer, combined them as the inspiration for Wormhold in Our Man in Havana, the spymaster with the imaginary network. Clifton James published a book in 1954 entitled I Was Monty's Double. He acted the part of himself and Monty in the film adaptation. Emil Kliman, Lily's case officer, was arrested by American troops in Louvain on August 20, 1944. He might easily have escaped with the rest of the German intelligence officers, but he was running late. The preceding weeks had been most unsettling for Kliman. Suspected of involvement in the July plot, wrongly, he was far too idle for conspiracy, his flat had been searched by the Gestapo, and he had then come under machine gun fire from the Free French forces as he tried to flee the city. He surrendered with alacrity and was imprisoned in Fresnes, where Chernovsky had once been held. Yvonne Delidais and her brother Richard were arrested the same day. Kliman's American interrogators found him somewhat shifty, responds well to flattery, talking as much to save his own skin and that of his fiancée as anything else. Quizzed about his intelligence work, Kliman grew crafty, explaining that he had run a top-level woman agent in Britain codenamed Tramp, and was very proud and gratified at the results achieved. Kliman then played what he thought was his trump card, suggesting that Treasure should be run, with his help, as a double agent, entirely unaware that she had been one from the start. He has no idea, wrote Little, that he himself is the sucker. Kliman was released in May 1945. He had been far too lazy to commit any serious crimes. He returned to Austria and his wife, taking with him his memories of Yvonne and a pigskin wallet from Dunhill's of London, inscribed to Octave, a souvenir from London. In the 1960s, an overexcited newspaper article on German spies described Kliman as having a sharp and ruthless brain. The clipping was inserted into his MI5 file with an eloquent one-word comment alongside that description. Kliman? More than 5,000 people were arrested in the orgy of violence and score-settling that followed the July plot of 1944. A few days before the attempt to assassinate Hitler, Georg Hansen told his deputy, Wilhelm Kurbat, to stand by to arrest various Nazis on the day of the attempt. The day after the bomb planted by Klaus von Stauffenberg failed to kill the Führer, Hansen and Kurbat were both arrested. Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo chief, orchestrated the bloody reprisals against anyone considered defeatist, disloyal, or ideologically suspect. Hansen and Kurbat were soon joined in Lehrter Straße prison by Alexis von Rühner, the anti-Nazi intelligence expert. Kurbat was interrogated as to why he had made difficulties over surrendering Johnny Jebsen. His answers were dismissed as a tissue of lies. Brought before the Volksgerichtshof, the People's Court, the prisoners were accused of conspiring with a small clique of cowardly officers to murder the Führer, to overthrow the National Socialist regime, and conclude an unworthy peace pact with the enemy. Hansen was executed by hanging on September 8, 1944, at Plötzensee Prison, Berlin. Von Rohner was executed next, without ever explaining whether his falsification of the Allied order of battle had been a deliberate act of sabotage. Canaris, the former Abwehr chief, was kept alive by Himmler as a possible pawn for use in negotiating with the British. But finally he, too, was killed in Flossenbürg concentration camp in April 1945, along with his deputy, Hans Oster, 2 weeks before the camp was liberated. Kurbat, surprisingly, survived. He had already written farewell letters after his lawyer said he considered the case already lost from the intrinsic gravity of the charge, when he learned he had been acquitted for lack of evidence. He was dishonorably discharged from the German army and spent the remainder of the war working on a farm. Gestapo Müller was last seen in the Führerbunker the day before Hitler's suicide. "Defend Berlin to the last man, the last bullet," he ordered, and then disobeyed himself by vanishing. His fate remains a mystery. Documents discovered in 2001 appeared to indicate that he was still in American custody at the end of 1945. Over the years, Müller has been variously cited in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Switzerland, Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Cairo, Damascus, Moscow, Washington, D.C., and New Hampshire. Alois Schreiber, Jebsen's kidnapper, went back to teaching the law. Ludovico von Karsthoff, or Krämer von Auenroda, to restore his real name, the pleasure-loving Lisbon Abwehr chief, fell into the hands of the Soviets and is believed to have been executed. Oskar Reiler returned to Germany and wrote no fewer than 3 academic works on the theory and practice of intelligence, in one of which he claimed, not quite credibly, that he had always suspected that Roman Chernovsky was a double agent. The spy catcher, Hugo Bleicher, wrote a substantially misleading autobiography, Colonel Henri's Story, and died in 1982. Karl Erich Kühlenthal became a wealthy and respected clothing retailer in Koblenz. He died in 1975, unaware of how thoroughly he had been duped. Hans Brandes, the betrayer of Johnny Jebsen, was arrested in Portugal and held in a civilian internment camp in the American-occupied zone in Germany. He convinced his captors that he was a poor, half-Jewish businessman and as a result was cleared, used as a trustee, and eventually released. MI5 was enraged to find Brandes had slipped through the net, describing his interrogation as pure whitewash and his release as a grave miscarriage of justice. Tar Robertson launched a manhunt. Brandes was mixed up with the kidnapping of Johnny. It would be a good idea to lay hands on him. But as time passed, the memory of his perfidy faded. By 1954, he was back in the family firm as managing director of Fritz Werner Machine Tools. On April 15, 1971, Hans Brandes was found in his car on a dirt road in Schaftlarn, near Munich, dead from poisoning. The investigators could never decide if he had been murdered or committed suicide. Johnny Jebsen was dragged into the Oranienburg sector of Sachsenhausen concentration camp in July 1944, a month after D-Day. Skeletally thin, he could hardly walk, and his hair had fallen out in patches. The camp, 30 miles north of Berlin, was a place of unimaginable horror. Over 30,000 political prisoners, homosexuals, gypsies, and Jews died there during the course of the war from exhaustion, disease, malnutrition, execution, or brutal medical experimentation. Petra Vermeeren, the journalist arrested after her son defected in Istanbul, was interned there and learned of Jebsen's arrival through the camp barber. She found out which cell he was in and threw stones at the window until she attracted his attention. Jebsen was overjoyed to see his old friend. In a whisper, he told her that the Gestapo had abducted him because he had divulged information to the British. He had been arrested on a charge of high treason, he said, but because he had refused to talk, he was now under investigation for Devisenverbrechen, the foreign currency crime of exchanging forged British £5 notes. Jebsen did not know it, but in Sachsenhausen, Himmler had employed a team of 140 imprisoned Jewish photographers, lithographers, and photo engravers to churn out forged British and American currency. His crime had been started in this prison camp by the very people accusing him. For the next 2 months, Jebsen lay on his bunk, his ribs too badly broken to stand. Completely cut off from the outside world, he was unaware that in Frankfurt, his wife, Laura, was pregnant with his child. But slowly, despite the starvation rations and freezing cold, his strength started to return, and with it, hope. Jebsen began to imagine ways to escape. A number of British prisoners were held at Sachsenhausen, including Lieutenant Commander Mike Cumberledge, a piratical Royal Navy officer with a gold earring, and Lieutenant Colonel John Churchill, widely known as Mad Jack, a commando who fought armed with a claymore, longbow, and bagpipes. Cumberledge had been captured in 1945 while attempting to blow up the Corinth Canal. Churchill had led an ill-fated commando attack on the German-held island of Brač in Yugoslavia in 1944. Surrounded by 6 of his men, he played "Will You No Come Back Again" on the bagpipes until a mortar shell landed, killing everyone but him, and he was captured. These were men, as the writer Saki put it, who wolves had sniffed at. Jepsen, a man who would have run a mile from a wolf, struck up an unlikely friendship with them both. In September 1944, Jack Churchill crawled through an abandoned drain under the camp wire and set off on foot for the Baltic coast. He was recaptured, transferred to a camp in the Tyrol under SS guard, and then set free by a German army captain after the SS moved out. He walked 93 miles into Italy and linked up with an American armored force. When Churchill finally got back to Britain, he produced a letter written by Mike Cumberledge to his wife. The letter contained a message in code that read, "Johnny Jepsen, Hun held high treason. Can D repeat D Popoff help? Urgent F.O. know of J.J. All charges against us are baseless." The Foreign Office had never heard of Johnny Jepsen, and to make matters worse, as the message was passed around, his name was garbled. I can make little of this. "We appear to have no record of any Johnny Jepsen or Debson," wrote one official. In February 1945, a Gestapo escort arrived from Berlin with orders to collect Jepsen and Heinz Moldenauer. Petre Vermeeren saw the two men leave under guard. On April 12th, Moldenauer was returned to the camp alone. He told Vermeeren that he was surprised not to find Jepsen back in Sachsenhausen already. The Red Army was now closing in. A week later, the SS ordered 33,000 inmates to begin the forced march northeast. Moldenauer was among the thousands killed on the way. Mike Cumberledge had already been transferred to Flossenbürg camp, where he was shot 5 days before it was liberated. Petra Vermeeren was one of 1,400 women still in Sachsenhausen when the camp was liberated on April 30th. She returned to Hamburg and resumed her writing career. Johnny Jepsen had vanished. Ian Wilson, artist's one-time case officer, set out to find him. A driven personality who never found the art of conversation, Wilson was a man of deep, if well-hidden, feelings and granite loyalty. "It was," he said, "my personal wish to help those who helped us, and none had been more helpful than Jepsen. I do feel that it is up to this office to use all possible diligence in finding out exactly what happened." Wilson owed Jepsen a debt, and, with the single-mindedness that was his trademark, he meant to discharge it. Recalling that Jepsen had spoken about meeting Marie von Gronau in a café in Flensburg 3 days after the end of the war, in May 1945, he wrote to the British intelligence officer in that part of Germany and asked him to be ready in case Jepsen turned up. "My old friend Johnny Jepsen stated long ago that when the Allies defeated Germany, he would hope to have made his way to Flensburg in Schleswig-Holstein. It is just possible that he may have been able to get himself to SH, in which case I have little doubt that he will get in touch with British intelligence. Should he come to your notice, it might be as well to have him sent to this country, purely for his own cover and protection. He knows my own name, which will serve as a password. I hope he has got the KVK, War Merit Cross, first class, which he said he was going to give me." Jepsen did not appear. Recalling the assurance we gave Johnny that if anything happened to him, we would look after the welfare of his wife, Wilson went looking for Laura Jepsen, who had by now given birth to Jepsen's son. With the help of Popoff, he found her in the Russian sector of Berlin, arranged for her to move to the British zone, helped her get a job back on the stage, lobbied MI5 to request the German government for a state pension, and found a lawyer to untangle Jepsen's financial affairs. "She will be able to live in comfort," he wrote. John Marriott could not understand why his colleague was going to such lengths. "We have no financial and very little moral responsibility for Mrs. Jepsen," he wrote. "Wilson is, as you know, obstinate, pertinacious, and kind-hearted, and he feels a great sense of responsibility." He shared that responsibility with Popoff, who, heartsick at the disappearance of his friend, launched his own hunt for Jepsen and those who had abducted him. He travelled to Switzerland and Germany, interviewing anyone who might know of his fate. Wilson and Popoff track down Yebsen's business associates, his lovers, and his secretary, Mabel Harbottle. None of these people had any definite information about what had happened to Artist. One of Yebsen's business partners, a Yugoslavian named Glusevich, said he had been quizzed by the Gestapo about Yebsen and formed the impression that the Gestapo had not extracted full information about anything from Artist. Wilson went hunting for the German officers, notably Chief Investigator Obergeheimrat Quitting, who would be most likely to know of Artist's ultimate fate. Popoff was keen for vengeance. "If you have luck and find the men, keep him alive until I come. I would love to have a few words with him." Quitting never resurfaced. The NKVD, it seemed, was also on the trail of Yebsen. Soviet intelligence officers had interrogated Popov's family in Yugoslavia before the war's end and seemed to know everything about Yebsen, including his visit to Lisbon. Wilson wondered how the NKVD could be aware of Yebsen's movements. The answer, of course, was Anthony Blunt. Wilson refused to lose hope. "We do not know whether or not Artist is still alive, but if he is, he may yet prove to be a valuable agent." He went back to work at McKenna and Company solicitors, but continued the hunt. Others came to the conclusion that Yebsen must be dead. Tar Robertson had shared Wilson's determination to find out what actually happened to him in the end, as Johnny did some extremely good work on our behalf, but reluctantly decided he must have been transferred to Mauthausen concentration camp, which was the normal place for internees to be sent who were to be killed. Popoff eventually came to believe that his friend had been shot while trying to escape. On February 17, 1950, a court in Berlin formally pronounced Johnny Yebsen dead. Wilson was not convinced, nor was Laura. "She refuses to believe he is dead," wrote Wilson. Petra Vermeeren, the last person to see him alive, was also emphatic that he did not die in Sachsenhausen. A rumor persisted that Yebsen was liberated by the Russians, only to be rearrested and consigned to some camp in Russia. That might explain the interest of the Soviet NKVD. A strange report from MI6, citing an American source in Lisbon, reported that Johnny Yebsen has left for England. In a post-war interrogation, Walter Schellenberg, the Nazi intelligence chief, stated categorically, "Yebsen has not been killed." The mystery lingered, but Wilson's investigations had proved one thing beyond doubt. Yebsen had kept the faith. He had never revealed anything to his captors about the double-cross plot, either before D-Day or after it. There is nothing to indicate that, whatever may have happened to him, he was forced to disclose facts which we wanted kept secret. Yebsen had taken his secret with him to the grave, or wherever else he had vanished to. Perhaps Yebsen was caught up in the last murderous spasms of the Nazi regime, as Tar believed, killed and tossed into some unmarked mass grave, like so many others. Or perhaps he made good his escape. In the chaos and confusion of those final days, it was easy to disappear. Heinrich Müller vanished, as did Quitting and other Nazis. So did Juan Puyol and Paul Fidromuch, agents Garbo and Ostro. Roger Michael, von Roerner's assistant, who may have spied for all sides, or none, reached the end of the war and then evaporated. Johnny Yebsen had the ingenuity, the means, and the motive to disappear. His funds had seemed to his colleagues inexhaustible, and he was an acknowledged expert in bribery. He had many debts to call in, many an underworld contact to shield him, and any number of places he could hide. He had bank accounts in Paris, London, Berlin, San Francisco, Dubrovnik, and Shanghai. He had every reason not to stay in Germany to discuss his questionable business activities with the authorities, and every motive to want to start afresh somewhere else, as someone else. Ian Wilson died in 1978, still wondering what had happened to his lost spy. The double-cross agents spied for adventure and gain, out of patriotism, greed, and personal conviction. They made an eccentric, infuriating, courageous, and astonishingly successful team. And the most important of them has disappeared from history, just as he vanished from the world at the age of 27. Johnny Jepson, former international playboy turned dodgy businessman, a young man of cynicism, black humor, deep intellect, and physical frailty, the chain-smoking Anglophile dandy who took up spying in order not to fight, but who defied the Nazis because he believed, above all, in friendship. He was unable to resist worldly temptations, but he resisted his Gestapo torturers to the end. Like many ordinary, flawed people, he did not know his own courage until war revealed it. Jepson might easily have turned history in a disastrous direction to save his own skin, and he chose not to. Agent Artist was not a conventional D-Day hero, but he was a hero nonetheless. This is John Lee. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Double Cross, The True Story of the D-Day Spies, by Ben McIntyre. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2012 by Ben McIntyre. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.